greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurick, Jack Spencer, Lisa Roos Church, Mike Malott, and Jacob Kanzler. Got the whole crew down here in the pit in the newsroom down here at MERS World Headquarters. A very special edition of the MERS Monday podcast, not only because we have our entire editorial staff for the first time this year, but because we are going to be naming our Freshman of the Year. We've got five nominees, and then we will name the freshman legislator who has been deemed by us as being the most effective in showing a level of activity and an impact that exceeded his or her colleagues. But we'll get to that later. First, we also had a very unique experience in being able to cover a sitting state representative in a federal trial. And we had three different reporters covering the Larry Inman trial. And we're going to start with our courts reporter, Lisa Roos Church. Tell our listeners what struck you about this. You've been covering courts for several years now. What was different about this case than maybe other trials that you've covered before?
For me, the difference was the verdict. They came back with a partial verdict. I've never seen a court take a partial verdict before.
And when you say partial verdict, you mean that they were hung on two charges, but not on one, and the judge accepted that.
Correct.
Why is that unusual?
I don't know. I've just never personally seen it. Normally, it's either a hung jury or they get a verdict. I've never seen, personally, a judge take a partial verdict.
Mike, what struck you about this trial in the days that you covered it?
Well, I was there for closings and for Larry Inman's actual testimony. I think that's the most unusual. The defendant actually testified in his own defense. Usually for this kind of a trial, they don't testify on their own behalf.
How do you think he did?
He was good. I don't know how much they would hit. Well, they must have found him credible because at least half of the jury found him credible. He got up there. He answered the questions. The assistant attorney general caught him in discrepancies a few times. But he held up.
He didn't flub. Did he seem nervous?
He was not the most nervous person on the stand, but he took it pretty straightforward. I can imagine that it was very intense, and that he must have felt the pressure while he was on the stand.
Jacob, what did you make of the testimony? Were you there for the Lee Chatfield day?
Yeah, I was. I was there for the speaker. And I was sharing with my colleagues. I didn't really know what his testimony kind of brought to the overall picture. I mean, maybe it was kind of part of the case that you know, the government was trying to make. A couple of people asked me if I was surprised at the verdict. In one way, I kind of was. But at the same time, I wasn't. In terms of the not guilty, I haven't covered a lot of trials, but in looking at how the defense mounted their case for Larry Inman, when you're in front of a jury of your peers, I feel like you can kind of make a more emotional case where you say, hey, this guy, you know, he's a good guy, he's trying to serve the people. Why are you trying to send him to prison for like 20 years over two text messages, you know? So I feel like you can kind of lean on some of those like emotional appeals, whereas maybe, you know, a judge wouldn't go for that. So that's the part that didn't really surprise me, I guess.
So were you there when the name of Representative Steve Marino came up and the questions about whether he should have been there to testify and their attempts to get him?
Oh, no, not that. He did come up quite a bit in testimony and his very infamous, if you will, book of votes for the prevailing wage. But his name came up a little bit, but I'm not sure how much his testimony was wanted, I guess.
I was there for quite a bit of the discussion about Steve Marino. And first of all, the infamous book isn't so infamous. They track votes all the time. This is the whip.
This is whipping votes.
Whipping votes, and they do it all the time, and they know exactly how people are going to vote. Somebody in leadership knows exactly how everybody's going to vote before they ever put it up on the board. And if they can't pass a bill, they don't put it up on the board. They let the sponsor go back and work that bill some more.
Unless you're Tom Leonard.
Unless you're Tom Leonard.
But anyway.
But that's besides
that's a
the
different point.
So his book is irrelevant to the whole thing. And
they kind of made him out to be a boogeyman, though, in this whole trial, didn't they?
Well, the relevant part was supposedly that Steve Marino was tracking the votes, realized that they were losing votes to block the repeal, that he had said something about going to call Lisa Canada, the union representative for the carpenters, and he had said something about, according to Larry Inman, I'm going to see if Lisa has given these other lawmakers their checks. Well, there's no evidence of that, and it's irrelevant because it would have come, it was supposedly the day before the vote, it would have come 3 days after Larry Inman sent the texts. So it had nothing to do with the actual issue.
But the serving
if he said it, because, said it, you know.
And this serving of the subpoena, he was very upset, Representative Marino was, when we talked to him about what happened about the subpoena and whether he received it and, you know, whether he was ever asked to come and testify at this trial.
Right. He was very upset. He was in the hospital one time when he was when the FBI tried to reach him. Another time, it was the anniversary of his mother's death. He said it was very well documented that where he was when the FBI was trying to reach him, and he made the point. He said, if the FBI wanted to talk to me, do you think that they wouldn't have been able to find me? And, keep in mind that since the indictments come down, Steve Marino has been sitting two desks away from Larry Inman on the floor of the House. Steve Marino hasn't missed a session day in quite a while. So,
well, since he recovered from that prolonged illness that you spoke of.
Yes.
And his other point was, if they wanted me to testify, all they needed to do was subpoena me, and I would have been there. Because he's required to, and he was concerned that without a subpoena, there would have been a separation of powers issue. Lisa, let's get back to what's going to happen going forward. Now, you were there when the verdict was read. The prosecution could come back and ask for another trial date. They haven't done so yet.
No, they did.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, they stood up in court after the verdict and said they wanted the court to set a trial date. Last I checked, it hadn't been set yet. That doesn't mean that they will pursue another trial, but it's probably a pretty good indication they're going to try.
Now, do you think that they will, considering that, from what we understand, the jury was pretty much split right down the middle on the two charges?
Well, that's what I'm told. They seem to have had a question as to the difference between the bribery and the solicitation. They wanted, one of their questions was something to the effect of, how do those two charges differ? Which kind of gave the reporter pool the impression that they were leaning guilty on one and not guilty on the other. But we didn't know which way. Hmm. That's what they questioned.
The jury wasn't particularly chatty after the decision was reached, was it?
Not to me. There were a couple, I think, that spoke out to other media. The ones I spoke with were really, really nervous about the media. The ones I spoke with indicated that there was reasonable doubt as to the first two charges, and there was a lot of healthy discussion and not a lot of people willing to budge from their position.
Well, Larry Inman was back at session and held court with reporters for the last couple of days of session, Mike. And from what I understand, he was trying to get his office back, his staff back, his allotments back. Right now, he's basically has a seat on the House floor and can vote yes or no on bills, but he has no committees, has no power. And the speaker hasn't taken expulsion off the table yet because the charges haven't been officially dropped. Apparently, he tried to use this as leverage to get on the switch vote. He was a no vote on switch. Apparently, he approached the speaker about saying, hey, I'll be a yes if you do X, Y, and Z. The speaker wasn't interested in bargaining.
Well, yeah. Apparently, there's a habit of trading votes there that is unbroken.
Something to do with switch, but it ended up that the speaker was able to get his 55 votes without having to go there with Larry Inman. And we'll keep track to see if that trial ever gets set again.
We never compromise. For the life of me, I cannot believe we'd ever die. For these sins, we were merely freshmen.
Okay, with that, we're going to move on to our Freshman of the Year Awards. We've been doing these annual awards going on 9-10 years now, in which we recognize legislators who have been particularly effective, have shown a level of activity that's maybe exceeded others in the legislature and have had an impact in their various endeavors and what they've done. And we've nominated five different freshmen, as we typically do, for this annual recognition. And John, we'll start with you with your nominee.
All right. I think when we started thinking about this, talking about this, this was an easy pick in my mind. I'm going to nominate Representative Graham Filler, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, as MERS 2019 Freshman Lawmaker of the Year. For only being in office 12 months, Filler's been in the middle of a lot of positive legislative accomplishments that have happened this year. His committee advanced the Raise Age bills. He was a sponsor of one of the Raise Age bills that became a public act, kind of important legislation that basically says children under 18 can't be charged as adults for crimes anymore. And recently, even now, he's been willing to sort of take on some tough issues like securing a pay raise for Supreme Court justices. Giving officials raises is not always popular, especially with Republicans, but he's taken on that battle. They haven't had a raise in 19 years. It just kind of shows a political courage that's rare for a freshman lawmaker. And he's done other things, too. I mean, he's working to eliminate the ban on 70-year-olds being judicial candidates, calling that antiquated. And his independence has also earned him some barbs. He's been the subject of a social media campaign by U.S. Term Limits, picturing him as the Grinch, and warning people about how Graham Filler stole term limits. When a lot of freshmen receives that kind of attention, a lot of them probably would have turned heel and said, oh no, I'm actually pro-term limits, and folded like a cheap suit, but he didn't. He went on to explain that, you know, we have the stingiest term limits in the country, and maybe we should look at it, maybe we should have a conversation. So he didn't kind of run away, and a lot of freshmen, I think, would have run away. So for a freshman, you could argue in a lot of ways he's had more accomplishments this year than a lot of legislators have in their six-year tenure in the House.
Jack, let's move on over to you, our Senate beat reporter. Who are you nominating for Freshman of the Year?
Senator Adam Ollier, and I know technically, I guess we're calling him a freshman. He actually was here earlier, but we're putting him in the freshman class, basically. I just think he comes at things from such an original angle, and it virtually always seems to be here something that you clearly show, for the most part, he has really put a lot of thought in whatever positions he takes. He has crossed over, as people know, every now and then on issues. For instance, we do remember he was the one Democrat that voted yes on the tunnel legislation.
Yeah, for the Enbridge tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac. That took a bit of political courage.
And he seems more willing to sort of at least contemplate and discuss some of these things that a lot of other people in his caucus, you know, kind of seems like almost automatic votes one way or the other on. He seems a little more willing. He may take the journey and end up in the same place as his colleagues, but it just seems like he's always has his own angle and his own way of saying, okay, I'm going to look at this independently and, you know, and take it where my conscience tells me to go. He's had a couple bills signed into law. He has basically he's got new legislation now on comparatively new legislation on the likenesses of college students,
allowing them to be paid for the use of their likeness.
Yes, and I think he's just set himself up to be somebody who. Boy, you know, when he wants to talk to somebody, I think anybody at all at the Capitol, there's not a lot of reason for anybody to sort of shrug it off and say, well, we know what he's going to say. I think they'd all be very interested any time because he could come from a totally different angle.
Well, and to that point, when I talked to him about the road funding and raising the gas tax, he was already talking about raising the sales tax on services. He was thinking in kind of a different way about how you can raise money, not necessarily at one specific sector that would hurt, the motoring public, but kind of expanding the tax base in general to be more fair. So kind of that point. I was also noting about his bipartisanship and the way he approaches things. He was one of the few Democrats to support the no-fault reform in the state Senate. So that was different. And he's been taking up the aggregates bill in the Transportation Committee, which isn't necessarily popular with locals, but he's coming at this as if we're going to get some additional help for our roads, then we got to get the gravel for it. And if that means expanding the ability for these companies to dig up this gravel from the earth outside of local opposition, then that's something we should look at.
Yeah, he doesn't just follow the line or whatever, you know, whatever the popular position is. Now, I don't want to make it sound like he's the only one who doesn't. There are other senators on this and that you could pick that out with, but it's his consistency of, boy, let's go ask Senator Ole about this, because it's always a really good chance you're going to get a totally different angle, and some kind of logical reasoning, whether you agree with him or not, is usually a big part of it.
All right, we're going to go to our administration reporter, Jacob Kanzler, and get his nominee.
All right, so my nominee for Freshman of the Year is Representative Julie Brixey. Here's what we found on her. So Brixey obviously comes from a safe Democratic seat. You know, you got East Lansing, Okemos. But we did a story on her before she was even elected to office about how she was raising thousands of dollars for the caucus. And so definitely a team player in a seat where she doesn't necessarily need to kind of outwork really anybody, sort of thing. And so in addition, and then since she's been elected to the legislature, she's been a big fundraiser. I have found a few of our stories where she was among the leaders in her caucus in raising money for the Democrats. And then early on in her term, she jumped on the red flag legislation. It's a big issue for Democrats and in terms of gun control measures. But she may be best known for us here in the office with kind of becoming the watchdog, if you will, on the House Republicans' efforts to raise money for roads out of the MDOT budget. She did a little bit of snooping around in the MDOT budget this summer and found a lot of interesting things that made some great headlines for us. I'm looking at one talking about the proposed sale of the Blue Water Bridge and how you know, a private business wouldn't make money on it for 62 years. And so she found some good stuff that kind of helped poke holes in the Republicans' arguments for what they want to do of road funding, which of course kind of helped the Democrats and Governor Whitmer's argument that we need new revenue for roads. And so Representative Brixey did this as a freshman in the minority party. She only sits on one committee, a standing committee, that is an appropriations committee. And so with those limitations, she was able to do those things. So that's why I nominated Representative Julie Brixey.
All right, our House reporter, Mr. Mike Malott, let's hear your nominee.
So I would like to nominate Matt Hall for Freshman of the Year. He's been very active as the chairman of the Oversight Committee. And of course, the point of being a legislator is to pass bills, but the watchdog function of the legislature is also very important. Oversight has been playing a critical role in that this year. Most notable, I think, is the hearings that Oversight has had regarding the audit of Child Protective Services, and that has resulted in a package of bills that is making its way through the legislature to not only assure that Child Protective Services is doing its job, but to smooth the to make things more efficient. It both requires CPS to do a better job and makes it easier for them to get rid of minor or frivolous cases. Matt Hall's bill, his own bill, would require that when a complaint of abuse or neglect comes in, that a CPS employee lays eyes on those kids within 24 hours, every kid in the household within 24 hours. And there's been some pushback from CPS as to whether or not that's doable, but Matt Hall is quite insistent that that's the important part of the law, is that they make sure those kids are safe within one day. He's not backing off it, and his committee has certainly agreed with him on that. Like I said, it also helps CPS because it allows them to get rid of frivolous cases faster through an abbreviated checklist. So there were certain things that CPS was doing that the committee agreed with, and they instituted that into law. Another audit that Oversight did was they looked at the Grand Rapids Veterans Home. Auditor General found that there was $300,000 that wasn't quite properly accounted for. It wasn't missing. It hadn't been stolen, but it wasn't in the correct accounts. And since it was the veterans' money themselves that they turned over to in order to be managed, it's kind of important that everybody knows where that actually is, and it wasn't being done correctly. Oversight held the department's feet to the fire on that. Another audit that they looked at was in DHHS on Medicaid payments. There's a comprehensive health care program, and through little billing errors, they came up with, the Auditor General came up with a figure that it might be costing the state $228 million in minor errors through medical billing. Oversight looked closely into that to try to get that corrected. Oversight also held the hearing on Gretchen Whitmer's flavored vaping ban, so you can't, that's a hot issue. Now he just this week got his first bill passed, which was one of the gaming bills. His bill would eliminate the prohibition on sports gambling.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mike. Now, as far as my nominee goes, before I give my nominee, I just want to give a special mention to a couple of freshmen who I thought deserve it. First of all, Mari Manoogian, representative out of the 40th District. I'm just impressed that for a freshman minority member in a politically competitive district, she actually got a bill passed out of the chamber. Now, you could debate how significant the change is, but the very fact that she got a bill out of the chamber is noteworthy in itself. Now, I understand it was part of a negotiated deal or what have you, but to put herself in a position through the issue of cell phone use while driving your car, to have a bill out there that could be passed by the House is a heck of an accomplishment. So congrats to her on that. I also want to mention Andrea Schroeder, a freshman Republican out of Oakland County. Many of our listeners may have read the story in the Detroit Free Press a couple weeks ago about her battle with stomach cancer and her ability to continue making session, never missing a vote, all while battling stomach cancer. And I just think that's an extremely courageous story. And I just think that it's particularly noteworthy for somebody who is going through that, was not given a very good chance. Her initial prognosis was not good, and yet she stuck with it and was able to have a very successful full result with that cancer diagnosis. So I do want to mention her. And then Matt Maddox, we mentioned the Transportation Subcommittee and their creative ideas in selling assets to raise money for the budget. It doesn't look like many of those ideas are going to come to fruition, but I thought it'd be worth mentioning the fact that he came to the table with some new and different creative ideas, and I think that's at least worth a mention that he was willing to go there. For my Freshman of the Year nominee, though, I'm going to go with Jack O'Malley, the Transportation Committee Chair in the House. I was just been very struck by the how serious he took the job of trying to find different ways to fix the roads without a 45-cent gallon gas tax increase. He held 12 hearings, 20 town halls, went across the state to talk with folks whose job it is to fix roads, and came together with a package that in many respects was kind of wonky. I mean, the average everyday folk probably doesn't really fully appreciate it. But he had the political courage to come out with the local option for municipalities to raise their own revenue locally outside of the property tax, to allow them to have their own gas tax, their own registration fee. And without opining on whether that's good or bad policy, the very fact that as a freshman he introduced that in a conservative area takes a lot of political courage. And I think he's done a good job selling it to his caucus mates. It sounds like he has support in the Republican caucus and the chamber to do it. I think they're waiting to see if the Senate would sign on to something like that. But he has done the groundwork in his own right to get that going. The Transportation Committee, I think, has been very active this year. They just recently took up some legislation to make sure that school bus drivers and the kids who ride them are more safe, with some advanced technology on that. So for those reasons, and for he also, I mentioned a Manoogian's cell phone bill just a little bit ago. He took that bill up along with two other bills that would basically limit your ability to use your cell phone in your car. Again, not opining on the legislation at all, but he took a very timely issue and one that had bipartisan sponsors and moved forward with that and moved that to the floor. So for those reasons, I'm going to nominate Jack O'Malley as my Freshman of the Year nominee.
We never compromise for the life of me. I cannot believe we'd ever die for these sins. We were merely freshmen.
So after consulting with the crew here, we do have a winner of the Freshman of the Year. We are going to take John's nominee and award Graham Filler with the Freshman of the Year. You know, the Judiciary Committee, I think it's fair to say, and I think Mike would concur with this, has been the busiest committee in the House all year. You wouldn't disagree with that, would you, Mike?
Oh, I wouldn't at all. And they've taken up a lot of important legislation.
So I counted them up. The committee has 286 bills that it had to manage this year. 286. 35 of those bills are already public acts. So a quarter of the public acts that have been currently signed into law by Governor Whitmer came through his committee, which for a freshman is quite remarkable. And then also, John, outside of all the things that you mentioned, he's also proposing a change to the Court of Claims, which the Court of Appeals apparently is starting to wonder if that's a good idea, that they're having the Court of Claims within their judicial branch and whether that can be moved back to the circuit court. So he's going to work on that issue as well. He's had a bill in the financial disclosure package for legislators, and he also has a bill in the FOIA package. Well, it's not really FOIA, I guess. It's what is it, the legislative... Laura, thank you. Thank you, Jacob. Laura, for all those reasons, the effectiveness, level of activity, and impact, we are going to name Graham Filler our Freshman of the Year.
Okay, it's Monday, and I'm at Oakland University. Had an opportunity to speak with U.S. Representative Alyssa Slotkin after her hour-long town hall here on campus at Oakland University. She spoke with the media immediately after a raucous meeting, and here's what she had to say.
I mean, listen, I knew that this controversial decision was going to be controversial when I came out for an inquiry, and we've been hearing from lots of people this whole time, you know, on the phones and when I'm walking down the street. I mean, we knew from the beginning that this was going to be a tough call, but, you know, you have to do what you're trained to do, and you have to take this seriously and make a decision sometimes on things that's a hard call, not based on polling and political calculus. And that's what I did. And that's why I made the point of coming out today. I mean, you know, I think a lot of folks could just submit an op-ed or do it kind of quietly. And for me, it was extremely important to come out and tell people directly what I thought was the right thing to do.
When did you actually make the decision and why?
So I spent the weekend doing what I was trained to do as a CIA officer. So I literally laid out all of the reports that came out from the House Intel Committee, the Republican rebuttal. I got the articles of impeachment. I then went back and got historical documents. So from the Nixon era, the Clinton era, the Johnson era. I looked at a big fat book that they give you when you start as a member of Congress called House Practice. I reread the Constitution and the Federalist Papers. I mean, again, as a CIA analyst, it's not just about one single piece of information. It's about the full body. So I did that quietly, you know, had my coffee and sat there at my desk at my farm in Holly and made the best objective decision that I could make. And like I said, I knew it would be controversial either way, and I feel very firmly that I'm doing what I think is right.
Are you concerned about re-election?
You touched on this during the town hall, but if you could expand on it, do you think you'll end up paying a political price for your decision?
Well, listen, I mean, you know, there's been articles written in the Detroit papers. There's been folks bringing that up to me ever since I came out. And I know it sounds different, but there just has to be some decisions that are beyond the political calculus. And it may be that voters decide in 2020 that they don't want me as their representative. I hope that's not the case. I really do. And I hope that even if people don't agree with my decision, they see that I based my decision on my personal integrity. And that is the most that I can do to show people that I hear them, even if we don't agree.
Do you face any pressure from House leadership? Most of
I did not. I have not been lobbied by House leadership or whipped, as we call it. I've certainly had people coming up to me on the House floor, members from both sides of the House, saying, here's my logic, here's why I think you should vote one way or the other. But there was a reason why I didn't stay in Washington all weekend and work this out there. I came home to Michigan to take a breath and take a stand back approach to this. And I haven't felt pressure from my leadership at all.
Are people hearing you who are on the other side of this? You gave your message today. There was a lot of shouting in the back throughout it. Do you think people are actually listening to your justification?
So what I appreciate, I mean, listen, there was, of course, protesters in that back corner. But, you know, from my vantage point standing up there, there is a room full of people with very different opinions. And sort of right in the center were a lot of folks who had on their Trump hats, who clearly didn't agree with where I was. But what I appreciated about them is that they listened. They weren't shouting. They were waiting to hear my answers. And that's the best I can ask for, is engaged citizens who came, who don't agree, but were willing to give me a chance to explain myself.
Agree about what actually happened. They have a different set of facts. They don't trust the intelligence community. They don't even trust your background as a CIA officer.
Yeah, certainly I've heard that before. That came up in some of my town halls right after I came out in September supporting an inquiry. And we literally just are going to have to agree to disagree. I do believe we live in a world where there are still facts, where there's still data, where there are still rules, and there are still standards. And I'm not going to mealy-mouth something just because I think it might go down easier for people who are critics of mine. As a former CIA officer, do not believe that the intelligence community and the FBI are acting against the president. I do not believe that. And while every organization can have their bad eggs, I do not believe those organizations are tainted. And I certainly don't believe that the president should go to a foreign government before he goes to his own law enforcement. So I tried to make that clear. That's just going to be a place where we're not going to bridge the gap, because I don't believe that there is a coup going on or that people are trying to overthrow the president.
Did you tell Speaker Pelosi before you published the op-ed of your decision? And if not, who did you share it with?
I did not. I think lots of members of Congress are coming out right now on both sides of the aisle and sort of explaining their logic. I did tell the others who wrote the op-ed with me in September. There were, I think, seven of us total who came out together at the same time supporting this idea of an inquiry. So I let them know what I was doing. I think they're all busy working on their own pieces and statements. Some of them have come out. I let a few other freshman close friends know. I let my fellow Congresswoman Haley Stevens know, because I know she's still working through this. So, you know, I practice what's called the doctrine of no surprises. And people don't have to agree, but I don't want them to be shocked or surprised by what I've done.
How do you feel this bodes for your party in 2020?
Well, listen, I mean, you know, again, I came to this decision very reluctantly. I was not a supporter of impeachment for many, many months. And that's when I would come to these events back in the spring and the summer. I had protesters pushing me towards impeachment and holding up signs that way. And certainly online and at our offices, we had lots of people pushing me that direction. And I didn't support it. And I felt very solid and grounded in that. But things changed. And if I made a decision just simply based on political calculus, then I wouldn't have come out for an inquiry, right? I know my district, and there's certainly a lot of controversy about this. But there just has to be a moment where you use the letter of the law for what they were intended. And I can think of no more important thing than to put a check on a president who has openly said he was reaching out to foreigners to ask them for help in a political process, in our political process.
Are you concerned?
You said you got thousands of emails and phone calls. How did they run, 50-50?
You know, we haven't done the exact calculus, but I think it was probably slightly more were against. And, you know, what I appreciate is there were a lot of letters and calls, not from people just kind of wanting to shout and make the political point, but who were clearly really struggling through this. And we heard this at the town hall, a couple of our town halls back in late September, early October. You know, like, listen, I don't like what the president did, but I just wish we could just deal with it through the election. You know, a really, an honest, thoughtful question and concern. And I said, I agree with you. I mean, some of these folks, we've obviously responded to them. We send letters. We engage with everyone who reaches out to us. And I've said, listen, that would have been my hope too. But I'm a member of Congress now. And there are certain things that are responsibility of leadership. And there are just some moments where you have to make the tough call, even when it's not popular. And that's what I felt like I was doing with this decision.
What are your right instincts? Do you think that voters will see how you made your decision on impeachment and support you in 2020?
You know, my hope is that people want elected representatives with integrity. My hope is that they say, huh, you know, I don't agree with everything that she's done, but I think she makes calls based on what she believes is right. And, you know, I learned a lot from people like Senator Carl Levin. You know, I would go up to people and somehow we would come up in conversation and they would say, you know, I didn't agree with him on a lot of things that he did, but the guy had a moral compass. And that is, to me, the gold standard in Michigan, and that's what I'm hoping my voters take away from these type of tough calls.
Congressman, do you think the president will ultimately be removed from office? How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, listen, I mean, I think it's long been predicted that the Senate is unlikely to convict. And I've gotten that question before. You know it's not going to end with him being removed from office, so why do this? And I think that that's a fair question. But when it comes to something like asking foreigners to intervene and get engaged here at home, that to me requires a response. It can't become normal to just reach out to foreigners. I really think about today it's a Republican president reaching out to the Ukrainians. Tomorrow it could be a Democratic president reaching out to the North Koreans, the Chinese, asking for just something small. And I cannot accept foreigners playing a role in our elections. And we have to be ironclad about that. And it was important enough for me to make a point, even if the Senate doesn't live up to its commitments.
Was the shouting today worse than you would have thought?
No, I think we knew that this was going to be tough. And frankly, we had people say, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you going up when you know there's going to be shouting and controversy and just put out your op-ed and leave it at that? You know, but I think back to 2017 when I was deciding to run for office. The spring of 2017 was the healthcare spring, right? We were all talking about the issue of healthcare. And how people would vote on repealing the ACA. And I remember criticizing my then member of Congress because he wouldn't meet in a truly open town hall. He wouldn't have an event that let people express their will. I can't criticize other people for being afraid to be in front of their constituents and then not do it myself. I have to be available. That's my job. And I'm going to continue to do that, even if there's protesters.
Why has this been so split along partisan lines if the facts are as clear,
maybe?
Yeah.
As you said.
It would have made me very happy to have others besides what I understand Justin Amash supporting this inquiry and now voting in support of impeachment. I do not think history is going to judge folks well on this decision. I think that with some hindsight, people are going to realize that you have to have a nation of rules and laws, and elected leaders have a special responsibility to stand up for those rules and laws, and politics be damned. And I'm sorry that my colleagues decided differently, and you know, there's lots of us taking risks with this decision, and I would hope that at least some of them would do so themselves.
What are your thoughts on the potential of Congressman Amash managing and part of the impeachment process?
I saw that. I think it's an interesting idea. I'd have to understand a little bit more on how it would work. I have no idea if he's interested whatsoever, but it's a new idea. And to me, I think the more we can demonstrate to people that this is an objective, serious process, the better it is.
Was this a hard decision, or was it effectively made in September with that op-ed?
No, it wasn't made in September for me. Because for me, again, it's not about, you know, each hour of the testimony and each new piece of information. You know, people have asked, like, is it one thing, one piece of information that really got you? And it's really not. Again, as a trained analyst, you look at the full body of things. And for me, the president and his lawyer, first and foremost, saying that they reached out and asked for an investigation of the Bidens, and then just the raft of first and secondhand information that came out through the testimony was very important. And it was that basic idea. So there wasn't one piece of information. It really was the full body. But the onus was really on the president. I wanted him to participate in the process and explain to me how this was a misunderstanding, how this wasn't right. You know, he kept saying that everybody does this. Well, demonstrate what you're talking about. But when he refused to participate in the process, he didn't give his side of the story. And I'm left with the body of information that was in the reports and that was in the testimony, and I made a judgment on what was in front of me.
Did you make that decision yesterday or Saturday or when?
Tomorrow. Yesterday was the pivotal day for me. And frankly, this past week, I happened to have been at a holiday party that was held at the National Archives. Just by chance, and it was a bipartisan holiday party. It was for the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. It's a caucus that I'm a member of. And you come in, and people made some speeches, and then you got to walk around the archives at night without lots of folks there. And at the National Archives, you have the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, things like the Magna Carta, I mean, like our fundamental founding documents. And sitting in that huge room, reading the Constitution, reading specifically the language related to the U.S. Congress and its roles and responsibilities, it was certainly an important reminder of my responsibilities as a leader.
What day was that holiday party?
We can get that for you.
It's last Tuesday.
It was either last Tuesday, but we can confirm that
for
you.
And when did you submit the op-ed?
Very, very early this morning.
Like
after midnight. I'm not sure. I'll have to talk to my team, but I know it left my hands pretty much after midnight, so sometime in the wee hours of the morning.
When was it
written? Yesterday.
You actually wrote it yesterday?
I wrote it yesterday.
Do you feel lawmakers and the people are as divided as they're being portrayed to be?
You know, I always think that, with no offense to anyone in the media, that a lot of the polarization that we have now on the ground has been imported from Washington, that people see the vitriol that is going back and forth among our elected leaders on TV, and it sort of seeps into our life here in Michigan. And to be honest with you, Michigan is a swing state, right? My dad was a Republican, my mom was a Democrat. It never used to be something we fought over bitterly. You know, in Michigan, we fight bitterly about sports. That is what we fight bitterly about. And I don't think anyone likes that vitriol. You know, we don't like sort of walking on eggshells at holiday meals, you know, which I just did at Thanksgiving. No one likes walking on eggshells around other moms when they drop their kids off at school. That's not how we are here. And I think that, you know, whatever side of the aisle you're on, people can agree that they don't want the fighting. And they just want their government to function and do its basic responsibilities with civility and decency. So that is what I try to live up to.
Congresswoman, can you talk about the experience of talking to a crowd where you had hecklers basically chanting the entire time you were speaking?
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, that's their right under a democratic system. They have the right to demonstrate. We certainly knew when we set this up and we got like 400 RSVPs very quickly that we were going to have the crowd. We saw people would forward me the emails that showed, you know, the rallying of the protesters and asking them to come and participate even if they weren't constituents. That's our system. And
but as far as you continuing to speak while they're heckling you.
Well, listen, I'm not going to let them stop my communication with my constituents. You know, they have the right to protest, but they don't have the right to prohibit anybody else from hearing the topic of conversation. And what I really respected about a lot of the Trump supporters in the room was the majority of them were not protesting and trying to yell over me. The majority were sitting. Some of them had signs. Some of them were wearing hats, but they were listening. And that is what I expect from people, is to just try and give someone else the benefit of the doubt. But I can't expect the protesters not to be there. And you just got to power through, you know. And I'm quite comfortable from my prior life in national security making tough decisions that people do not agree with when I know it's the right thing to do. That is something I am comfortable doing.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the crew here at MERS and also AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.